Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
Books. Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Gutenberg? It's a rhetorical question, sir. But where would we be without books?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today, I have as a guest Kevin Wilson, who has just written his first novel, The Family Fang. It's published by Echo. It's a delightful, whimsical, hilarious, and original book. Perhaps I can best characterize the writer by telling you that his son's middle name, he just had a first son, and that son has the middle name Fodderwing. Now, how did that come about?
Fodderwing, I got to choose the middle name. My wife chose his first name. And so I went back to one of my favorite books of all time that I read when I was first read when I was 10 years old, The Yearling by Marjorie Kinnan Rawlings, which I read maybe once a year. It's one of the few books that I reread often. And there's a character in the novel, Fodderwing, who is a disabled, kind of slightly deformed boy who is known for communing with animals, being able to speak with animals, and being able to tell these imaginative stories. And he's the best friend of the main character. And there's a line where the boy, the main character, is going to meet with Fodderwing the next day, and he's thinking about it, and he says something to the effect of, he knew that what Fodderwing would say would be strange, but it would also be wonderful. And that always stuck with me, that idea that the connection between something that's beautiful and something that's bizarre, which was embodied in Fodderwing the character. So I loved that character through my whole life, and I thought if I could name my son that, it would be great. So my wife let me do it.
That's great. One of the main characters in the novel, The Family Fang, says about himself when he's discovered what very well might be his true love, that he's had sex so infrequently that he can count it still on the fingers of his hands and still have enough fingers left to make complicated shadow animals. And I just thought, what a good companion to have for a narrator, someone who could say something so, at the same time, humbling and so hilarious.
Oh, thank you. Well, I thought, you know, when I remember writing that line and thinking, I imagined the character Buster himself imagining himself counting and then utilizing the number of remaining fingers to actually make shadow animals. That comparison worked for me, but I thought it would also work that the character himself would probably do that with his hands, would make shadow puppets.
Now he, Buster, is a member of a very unusual family, the Fangs.
The thing with this family is that it's a totally invented name. It's one that they've created for themselves. It's not a family name.
They are Camille and Caleb Fang. And tell about the family.
Well, Caleb and Camille met when he was teaching art in California, and Camille was his student and one of his best students. And they have formed this kind of alliance, and they believe that the only art that is worthwhile is art that disrupts the world, and it has to exist in the moment. They don't think that painting or photography or books or even music on some level are genuine forms of art because they don't happen in the moment where the listener receives it as the event is happening. And so they have this very strict idea of what art is, and they think that it's chaos, that chaos is art. And so the problem comes when they have children, and then they have to figure out how do they take this idea of art and build that upon the idea that they now have children that they have to take care of.
They are legendary performance artists, and they are famous for entering malls and interrupting things. They've got quite a dossier and a reputation. At a certain point in the book, they die or disappear, and we discover that, you know, they've gotten almost every grant imaginable available in the art world. But we as readers get an inside look at how horrible it is to grow up with completely unpredictable parents who don't need to tell you what's going to happen when you go with them into that mall where they're planning to interrupt. And so this boy and this girl live a life that has completely, shredded them. They're discombobulated, and they're trying to get their feet back on the ground and have a life for themselves. Well, something of a life.
That's true, and I thought more and more about it, and then we had my son, Griff, was born, and it really startlingly hit home that I, as the parent, was responsible in some ways for the formation of this object, this child, and that was terrifying to me, and one of the ways that I tried to deal with it was to figure out the way that I do with everything, which is to take it to the worst possible conclusion, is that I always think of what is the worst possible way this can end for us. And so I invented the fangs, and I thought this might be the worst possible way to parent, and let's see what happens if I put these kids close to these parents and what happens to them.
Young Griff Fodderwing Wilson has a novelist for a father and a poet for a mother, so it became natural for said novelist and poet to wonder, would this have a profoundly disorienting effect on the life of a growing child in the world?
Right, and there's a character in the novel that has this mantra that he tells to all of his students, which is that children kill art, that the introduction of children into your life will ruin your artistic enterprise. And that was a legitimate concern that I was putting into the book, was what would happen now that my wife and I had this son, what would happen to the things that we wanted to make, and would they still get made? And, you know, I think maybe I was putting way too much power in Griff's hands, my son's hands, to stop me from creating something. But it was something that I totally was worried about, was the book that I'm actively writing, am I going to be able to finish it, or is having a child going to make it more difficult? And I think I was worrying over nothing in a lot of ways. If anything, he helped me understand more what it means to be a family and what it means to care for each other. So what I thought was going to keep me from writing the book probably gave me the insight I needed to figure it out.
Almost everyone who's commented about it has seen that this is a book, well, you just love it. It's funny. It's got its black humorous qualities, but you really feel like you're in such good-humored hands that you don't feel threatened that these children are going to be damaged forever. In fact, it's the generosity of Kevin Wilson that he lets us feel what it feels like to be a worried father. I think this novelist imagines himself to be far more eccentric than he actually is, and so he invents the family fang, and they do these events, these bits of performance art, some of them quite complicated, some of them more than 10 years in the planning, and, well, the book is punctuated with documentations of their performances. Can you tell about a couple?
Yeah, so the family sets up various performances, and they unleash these events upon unsuspecting people. They can't take place in a gallery. They have to exist in the real world. And for them, public places like malls or parks are best because you get a large gathering of people and you can kind of insert yourself into those situations. So, for instance, the Fangs have their two children, Annie and Buster, perform on guitar and drums in a park, singing songs. The kids do not know how to play their instruments. They are terrible singers. But they have a sign that says they're performing to raise money for their dog who needs an operation. So you have this audience watching the children and in some ways supporting them until the parents who have inserted themselves into the situation begin to heckle the children. which causes the crowd to become angry. And little by little, the more the parents heckle, the more other people take part, until the audience is kind of taking out their unhappiness and their frustrations on the children themselves. And the children, who are simply a part of the art, still can't help but feel emotionally affected by their parents screaming at them and all these other people. And so they create these kind of disturbing moments that aren't just disturbing for the people who witness it, but for the children who have to take part.
And in fact, early in the book, we witness them howling the song, because they're neither singers nor musicians, that suggests that all parents be killed. kill all parents. And you can hardly blame them, except their father has written this song for them to sing. So it's a very, what would you say, lunatic, zany, and heartbreaking group that you're reading about. But instead of being merely silly, you seem to have, dare I call it, a program where you move through the zany to the heartbreaking to the profoundly inexplicable.
Well, thank you. I mean, that is my goal. I do think that lightness and humor is always my entry point into a story. I feel that if I can make that work in a narrative, then I can pull a reader into a story that they might otherwise not be willing to enter into. And so if I can bring them in with lightness and slowly, slowly through the story introduce the fact that there is real darkness underneath that, the reader is kind of stuck. They can't get out of it, and now they have to deal with the kind of deeper, larger issues that are underneath that lightness. That's always my game, is to, I don't know if I should be tricking the reader, but I feel like if I can trick the reader into getting on board with the silliness, I can more easily hit them later with the sadness.
I'm talking to Kevin Wilson about his first novel, The Family Fang. He's really, to my mind, a beautiful discovery. I read this book in a day and a half, couldn't put it down, found it so funny and odd that I kind of, when I wasn't reading, those rare seconds when I wasn't reading, would wonder if the book really existed or if it was part of an ongoing dream. I think that very special books have this quality of creating so much nihilistic imagination that you don't know how to feel about the reading experience. Is it real? Is it a dream? Is it a comedy? Have you gone berserk? Could this exist? It's one of the great thrills of reading this book. You feel as if your own reality is being questioned.
I certainly felt my own reality being questioned when I was writing it, so I'm glad at least some of that seeped into the book. You know, I was down in the basement while my wife and child were above me, and I was writing this book, and I could feel this pull between a fictional family and a real family, and there were times when I was with one or the other, and yet thinking or imagining or believing that the fangs were real. And when I was with the fangs, I could hear my son crying. There was this strangeness that for a while there were these two separate families that I was a member of. So it was, for me, hypnotic and strange trying to kind of process all that.
What I love about The Family Fang is it has that feeling, here's the real life of these extraordinarily whimsical people, but who take themselves very seriously as artists and are very proud to be training their children as artists to be. And the idea that these children would ever want to leave home and not be subjected to the constant probing and manipulation of these incredibly unperceptive parents. I mean, there they are yelling at their children from this audience, they stink, learn to play your instruments, oh, you call that a voice? And, you know, these kids are expected to withstand their parents' taunting.
The parents think they're doing a great service for their children. And there's a moment in the story when the children are angry with their parents for a particular performance. And Mr. Fang, Caleb, says, you know, you're artists. We're just trying to show you how it works. And he says, you know, even when we die, you'll be able to do this. And in my mind, I just thought, that is not going to happen for these kids. Once you die, you know, that will be the end of it.
There's a midpoint in the book where the comedy and the pathos seem completely balanced. They've decided that their son is going to enter a beauty contest and win, what's the prize?
The Little Miss Crimson Clover, a beauty pageant, yeah.
Well, he does win, and they don't want him to want the crown. They're trying to make fun of beauty pageants. They're trying to use their art to ridicule the whole set of values that celebrates a beautiful girl. But he's gone to such terrible effort to throw his chest out and strut like a candidate that when he wins, he really does want his crown.
Yeah, and this is one of those moments where I think it hits home just what the parents are doing to the children, and that is that the parents expect these children who are 6, 7, 8 years old, they expect these children to understand that there is a level of artistic enterprise over everything. And the children, in a lot of ways, can't process that. So when you force this child into this very realistic situation and expect them to understand the artistic complexities of that moment, all Buster understands is that he's wearing a wig, he's in a beauty pageant, and his parents want him to win it. So when he finally gets the crown, it's impossible for him to remove the actual feeling of accomplishment, of happiness, of joy. And his parents would say, no, the joy is not in winning. It's in the artistic enterprise that will follow the win. And that's just, I don't think that's possible for these kids.
Listeners, ladies and gentlemen, this is, of course, the character who later in the novel tells us, well, it's a bit pathetic that he's had sex so infrequently that he can count the times on the fingers of his hand and use the rest of his fingers to make complicated finger puppets. In other words, they've destroyed his ability to have, well, interactions and feelings and feel safe during sex, unless he feels that there's a cataclysm in the wings waiting to happen.
Right. I think the parents, what they've done an incredibly good job of doing is teaching the children not to be afraid of chaos. But the problem is the children, when they become adults, have been so perfectly trained by their parents that they walk into bad decisions without totally understanding that they shouldn't be walking into those moments. They've been trained to run headfirst into a disaster. And so it makes their interpersonal relationships almost impossible.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from KCRW. And I'm talking with Kevin Wilson, the author of the novel The Family Fang. It's his first novel. We'll continue after this short break.
If you're listening to Bookworm, chances are you're a big reader. Connect with other book lovers. Join our virtual book club on Facebook. Go to kcrw.com/bookworm for more info. Thanks.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking to Kevin Wilson about his book, The Family Fang, a hilarious book which becomes unaccountably moving and then takes its emotional pathos several levels higher up and enters the level of great art, of mystery, of touching and, well, I would say, inexplicable complexity of feeling. These children do grow up to become, one of them, a writer, the other, a film actress. They're both gifted at what they do, one might say sublimely so, And they even have what for them is something of a happy ending. Now, can I ask you, since you're a novelist, your wife is a poet, what were your parents like?
Well, my parents were, on the surface, incredibly normal people without any interest in art. My father is an insurance salesman. My mother is a homemaker. They were a kind of charmed couple. They met in high school. They're the only people they ever dated. My father was the captain of the football team. My mother was the homecoming queen. And on the surface, they were just these beautiful, normal people. And yet underneath that, they were these deeply and wonderfully strange people that appreciated imagination. And so when my sister and I were born, they made our house, they made our lives inside that house within the family, one of pure imagination and I would say fun. So they encouraged us to be as strange as we wanted to be without any judgment on their part. And that was liberating for me as a child to not understand that that what was weird was something to be avoided. With my parents, what was strange was something to be exalted.
Now talk to me about tone, because it seems as if you yourself like it when chaos is in the wings and ordinary life is becoming a bit strange.
Well, I think, I mean, for me personally, my default mode is anxiety. And one of the byproducts, I think, of being raised by my parents was they told us, I mean, they would tell us that this world that we live in, my parents had created, and is wonderful and it's beautiful. And yet they made it clear that it was not like the outside world, and that the outside world was different and there were different expectations and possibilities. And so what happened was, once I left that and I became an adult, the outside world became kind of terrifying to me. It seemed a place where weirdness was not encouraged, where strangeness was something to be hidden. And so it made me afraid to go out into the world, because I was constantly afraid of being told that I was at fault or doing something incorrect. So for me, on a daily basis, the world seems like a place where disaster is always about to happen. Even in the smallest, tiniest interactions with people or places, I think that something terrible is about to happen. And so I think that filters into my fiction, which is, for me, just an average, ordinary life is one that is constantly having to avoid the possibility of flat-out chaos.
Now, you seem to be a writer capable of boundless levels of invention. Is that you as a person? Because this book, it's like watching popcorn pop. I mean, the kernels keep exploding, and there are more and more and more.
Well, I think, I mean, part of it is my being ill at ease with the real world means that the place where I'm not ill at ease, the place where I'm comfortable, is in my head. And so I tend to spend an inordinate amount of time within my own head creating fictions, fantasies, and not just narratives for novels, but just imaginary worlds or characters or ideas. And so because it's a place where I'm comfortable, I think it's something that I've just trained myself to do it quickly, to invent strange or weird things, or not, you know, things that just aren't real. It's where I feel most comfortable.
Could we hear a little bit, just to close? I want just a taste.
Sure. This is one of the pieces by The Fangs. It's called The Sound and the Fury, March 1985. Artists Caleb and Camille Fang. Buster was holding his drumsticks upside down, but Mr. and Mrs. Fang thought this made it even better. The boy spastically pressed his foot on the pedal that operated the bass drum and flinched with each percussive note. Annie strummed her guitar, her fingers already aching not 5 minutes into the concert. For two people who had never learned to play their instruments, they were managing to perform even more poorly than expected. They shouted the lyrics of the song that Mr. Fang had written for them, their voices off-key and out of sync. Though they had only learned the song a few hours before their performance, they found it easy to remember the chorus, which they sang to the astonished onlookers. "It's a sad world. It's unforgiving," they yelled at the top of their lungs. "Kill all parents so you can keep living." In front of them, an open guitar case held some coins and a single dollar bill. Taped to the inside of the case was a handwritten note that read, "Our dog needs an operation. Please help us save him." The night before, Buster had carefully written down each word as his father dictated it to him. "Misspell operation," Mr. Fang said. Buster had nodded and wrote it as O-P-E-R-A-S-H-U-N. Mrs. Fang shook her head. "They're supposed to be untalented, not illiterate," she said. "Buster, do you know how to spell operation?" his mother asked him. He nodded. "Then we'll go with the correct spelling," his father said, handing him another piece of cardboard. When it was finished, he held up the sign for his parents to inspect. "Oh, good Lord," said Mr. Fang, "this is almost too much." Mrs. Fang laughed and then said, "Yeah, almost." "Too much of what?" asked Buster, but his parents were laughing so hard they didn't hear him.
That was Kevin Wilson reading a piece of performance art from The Family Fang, from the novel The Family Fang, a great and very startling surprise, a pleasure to read and laugh about, and a pleasure to talk to you, Kevin.
Oh, thank you so much.
You've been listening to Bookworm. I've been talking with Kevin Wilson. His novel, The Family Fang, is published by Echo. You can comment on today's show or read an excerpt at kcrw.com/bookworm. Download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes. You can also listen on demand with KCRW smartphone apps. My co-producer is Connie Alvarez. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. Special thanks to recording engineer Paul Ruist at Argo Studios in Manhattan. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcasts, the most recent ones, at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.
Read this, read that, read this, bookworm. Read this, read that, read this. I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. We are all bookworms.